today's sutta is called the Akankeya Sutta, translated here as If a Bhikkhu Should Wish. And of course, there's nothing about bhikkhu in the title. Akankeya just means if one should wish, basically. That's what it means. So it might refer to anybody, not just to bhikkhus. And this sutta is nice and fairly short, so it's not going to take an enormous amount of time. And this sutta is a nice example of the gradual movement of the path, how you start off with the simple factors, and then how you move all the way to awakening. It's interesting, it's always fascinating how almost all the suttas have that pattern, how you start from the beginning here, and how gradually you move from the start all the way to the end of the path. It's always almost exactly the same pattern here. So if you have some doubt about how to interpret a sutta, understand a sutta, if you think in terms of gradual movement, you always have a very good starting point in how to interpret these things, which is very, very useful. As often, there are many of the factors here that are very profound. You come towards the end of the sutta. It's about awakening experiences, about psychic powers, about jhanas, about immaterial states, and all these kinds of things. But the beginning of the sutta is very nice and simple. It contains a number of fairly basic things about how to practice and the early things that you move into. Once you get to the jhanas, you're getting into the really kind of high states. But there's lots of things here, or at least a few things that are prior to that on the Buddhist path, and very inspiring, some of these things. So let's see what the Buddha has to say here in the Akankeya Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove and Atapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts." Okay, so that is just the introductory paragraph for you. And you can see here the very, very strong kind of emphasis here on basically keeping the precepts and keeping the rules. And this seems to be one of the features in particular of the Theravada tradition, this emphasis on rules. It is fascinating that in the some of the other schools, in particular the Samvastivada tradition, they often talk about the three types of sila, where the Theravada talks about the Patimokkha and about precept keeping. The three types of sila are the bodily, verbal, and mental conduct, right? So it's a different emphasis. The emphasis there is more on a holistic idea of what virtue actually means in terms of the three types of bad conduct. Whereas in the Theravada, it seems often they talk about precepts. And it's important to understand that these are essentially just different terms for the same thing, right? When you look at the precepts, it doesn't mean that you kind of focus on these things exclusively. They are just like a proxy for understanding virtue in a wider context. And in the same way, when you talk about virtue in the wider context, like the Sarvastivada, it obviously includes the precepts. It's not kind of different from that. There are different ways of looking at the same thing. But in the end, it is the three types of virtue, the three types of sila, that actually are the essential thing. That's actually what matters. And the idea of precept is something which falls in within that. It's a smaller thing. So if you want to know what virtue is, it's always the three types of conduct. That's the most important one. That's the broadest kind of container which contains all other expressions of virtue. Dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha, of course, is the rule of training rules found for the monks, the bhikkhus, and also the bhikkhunis. The bhikkhunis have their own Patimokkha, slightly different from the monks, but also in large parts overlapping with that one. So you are restrained by that. This kind of holds you back, right? This idea of the Patimokkha. You don't transgress it, so it holds you back in many ways. And then it has perfect in conduct and resort. So what does that mean? What is the idea here? And the idea, the word for conduct here is achara. And achara means something very similar to sila. It means how you conduct yourself. So basically, it refers back to sila again. So you're perfect in sila. sampan or him is either perfect or it means endowed with, either one of those. So you perfect your virtue. This is essentially what the meaning of that is, of conduct there. You could perhaps also extend it a little bit in more kind of the deportment of a monastic, that you behave in a way that is appropriate for a monastic, but in large part that comes under sila anyway. It's part of the seikyas and those kind of rules. So conduct is really nothing but sila here. And resort, now this is an interesting word. The Pali word here is gochara. And gochara, quite literally, go means cow, right? I think it's actually related to the English word for cow, go. And chara means a place where you hang out. It's where you walk, basically, where you are. So this is the kang hangout. That's what this is. The cow hangout, of course, is the pastures, right? The pastures is where the cows eat their grass and where they live their lives. So the root meaning of this word, gochara, is actually just pastures. That's what it actually means. So what are the pastures then for a monk or for a nun or indeed for a layperson? And these pastures, it depends on what aspect of that your training you're looking at to know what are the pastures. So in meditation, they say in the suttas that the gochara in meditation practice is a satipatthana. That's the pasture. That's where you hang out. That's where you are, right? Everything else fades away except for the meditation object of the satipatthanas. But in a broader context, for example, you have the pastures is also about who you hang out with, who are your acquaintances, who are your friends, who are the people that you deal with in daily life. And for a monastic, there are a number of types of people which would then be considered inappropriate to have socialize with. And these, of course, are people that are, in particular, people that are considered immoral, people who are, bandits or thieves, or people who are gamblers or whatever. Another classical case are prostitutes would be inappropriate for a monk to hang out with. And, of course, there are many reasons for that. One of the main reasons is if you hang out with the wrong kind of people, you get influenced by that, right? We all know the idea of the Kalyanamitta as one of the foundations of the Buddhist path is precisely because you get so influenced by the people around you that who you're with actually matters so enormously. It takes us always back to the saying of the Buddha, the holy life is one, or Kalyanamitta is 100% of the holy life. That's how important it is. That's how conditioned we are by the people around us. And Ajahn Brahm always likes to say that he brainwashes people. And basically that's what this is about, isn't it? You hang out with the right people, you get conditioned in a certain way. That's basically what brainwashing is. And if you hang out with the wrong people, you get brainwashed in the wrong way. So that's why you avoid all these other people. That's the gochara, is where you hang out, who you're with, who your friends are, who your acquaintances are. And you could extend that also to places, not just to people. But people and places are so intertwined. The place is usually good or bad because of the people. So I think the people is probably the most important part here of gochara. And that's how it often is also stated in the suttas. So the gochara is the resort. It is the what you do with yourself, basically. So you have good conduct, and you hang out with the right people. And when you do that, the last part here is seeing fear in the slightest fault, he trains by undertaking the training precepts. So the way it is phrased here, it seems to be saying that because you see fear in the slightest fault, because of that, you undertake the training precepts. The way it is translated, that's how it actually comes across. Seeing fear in the slightest fault, he trains by undertaking the training precepts. But actually, the Pali doesn't necessarily make that connection at all. There's two different issues here. One is seeing fear in the slightest fault, and the other one is trained by undertaking the training precepts. And actually, it matters. That little distinction actually is important. And it is important because sometimes training in the precepts is not enough, right? Training in the precepts gives you a framework for what you should do. Certainly, if you don't transgress those things, then there are many wrong things you won't be doing, which, of course, is good. But the point is that there are many bad things you can still do, even if you keep the precepts. In particular, in Buddhism, where the idea of the conduct of the mind is so important, the mental sila is so important. And mental sila is never captured by precepts, never captured by rules. And so this is part of seeing danger or fear in the slightest fault, that you understand that even your mental conduct actually matters. So this is broader than precepts. So this is, I think, an important point to always keep in mind. The other thing here is that fear, I think, is better translated here as danger. So seeing danger in the slightest fault, understanding that it takes you away from the path, it takes you in the wrong direction. It kind of sullies the mind. It does things which are, you know, it basically takes you in the wrong direction. So when you keep that in mind, when you understand the danger in these things, it's sort of, even in the slightest things, then gradually, you get yourself in the right direction. Very interesting, this idea that you see danger in the slightest fault. You don't think, oh, that's a small thing, it's fine. No, you don't think like that. You think, okay, how can I overcome even this problem in the future? And then what you do is you undertake the training precepts on that basis. And this, of course, then would mean the Patimokkha rules for a monastic, and then for whoever else, it would then depend on what you do. It would be whatever precepts you undertake in your life. So this, then, is the starting point. And in the Pali version here, we see that this is like the framework for this sutta. And when you come to the end of the sutta, this paragraph is repeated. So it becomes almost like when you have a beginning and an end like that, it's almost like the whole body of the text explains this particular paragraph, right? The other one is like the framework around it, and the body explains this part. So in a sense, what this sutta does, it tells you then the result of practicing virtue from the Pali version here. That's what it actually does. It's interesting, though, that if you go to the Chinese version of the sutta, it's actually quite different. And it lacks this particular paragraph, and instead it starts directly with what is the third paragraph here. It begins there instead. So in the Chinese, the emphasis is not so much on the actual virtue as such. It is more on what we will see next here, which is a refrain which talks about the practice in the broader context. And that is the actually what the Chinese version of the sutta seems to emphasize instead. That is one of these things where you can see how the suttas are slightly different, marginally different, as you go from one tradition to another one. Not really in substance, but more in emphasis and how they look at these things. So let's then stick here with the Pali. So if you practice in this way, then what happens then? And what happens then, and this is where the kind of gradual progression of the path begins at this point, and we have the very first factor here of a large number of factors. Altogether, it is something like 15 factors here, I think. The very first one. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, respected and esteemed by them, let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight and dwell in empty huts. So the first part here, these are the things that you are wishing to obtain in your holy life, right? May I be dear and agreeable is the first one here. And then it goes on all the way to the destruction of the asavas, to arahantship at the end. That's the first aspect here. The second aspect is what you need to do to get these things. So we have already seen the paragraph on virtue, and now the path is explained in much more detail here. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. This is what we should do. So this is the practice. So the first one here is, let him fulfill the precepts. Now already here, we can see here the importance of actually reading the Pali, because what is translated here as precepts is actually sila in the Pali. And to me, it is not all that satisfactory to translate sila as precept, because precepts, usually in the Pali, are sikapada, right? You take the precepts, you take the sikapadas as you practice. But here, it's not really about sikapadas, it's about sila, it's about conduct, really, in the larger sense. And this is really the root meaning of sila, is conduct. behavior, how you actually are. And again, like I just said before, there is this important distinction between conduct as a general term and precept as a very specific thing which relates to particular instances of conduct. Conduct as a general term of sila covers everything. It covers right speech. Even things that are not mentioned in the precepts are covered by conduct in the broader sense. So a classic example which I like to mention, if you look at the Patimokkha for the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, you actually find that there are certain aspects of, if you torture somebody, it's actually not covered by the precepts. You cannot kill living beings. You cannot hit a fellow monk or hit somebody. But if you kind of torture them in a more refined way, it's not covered by the precepts at all. So you can get away with some very unwholesome conduct, even if you keep the precepts. And this is the thing. You will see this is true throughout. There are so many loopholes. Once you fix things into a legal system, there are lots of loopholes there, things that fall through the system which aren't caught by it. That's why it's so important not to focus exclusively on precepts, but actually think, what is the mental state here? What is the mind like? What am I actually saying? What am I actually doing? Am I doing what is right? Am I doing what is kind? Or am I doing what is bad? So the precepts are just like a guideline for when you lose your sense of clarity or something is very difficult to understand. But this is really the broad aspect of virtue. Very important to keep that in mind. And of course, not only the other thing which distinguishes here precepts from sila, not only is sila broader and it captures many things which precepts don't, but also sila has a positive side, right? There's a good conduct. There's do sila and su sila. And this is never captured by precepts either. So I think, and this you can see here, that sometimes when you rely on translations and you may not agree with the translator, sometimes little things like that can kind of fall through, unfortunately. So that is the first one. And then once your virtue is intact, you have fulfilled your precept. An important word here is the paripurakari, which is to fulfill. It literally means to fulfill. It's not just doing it, it's actually trying to complete it, whereby it becomes virtually perfect. This is really the idea here. So it has a very high standard of keeping good conduct. And when that conduct becomes really good, then you can devote yourself. Again, you can see the gradual training here within a small paragraph, right? Only one sentence here. You can see the graduated training already here. You fulfill the precepts, then you become devoted to internal serenity of mind. And this is the Cetto Samatha. This means samatha is just samatha, right? It's the calm, the peace of the mind, and this is what you are devoted to here. So this is anything that gives clarity of mind, anything that gives calm of mind. Going on a retreat, practicing sense restraint, doing meditation practice, anything which gives rise to a calm mind is part of that. You're devoted to Cetto Samatha. But in particular, of course, it means doing things like anapanasati, satipatthana practice, which makes you peaceful and calm. That is the most important aspect probably of that. So fulfill the precepts, then you move on to satipatthana or anapanasati, one thing after the other. And then it has not neglect meditation, is the next one here, which is really not a good translation. The Pali here is anirakata jhana. Anirakata jhana, it means not neglect. Jhana, that's quite literally what it means. It also means something more as well. It means also neither neglect jhana nor kind of neglecting it or thinking that it is not necessary or something like that. Removing it from the path or whatever. It has a kind of slightly double meaning there. But basically not neglect jhana. You can see there the important difference again. Anirakata jhana. And it's actually defined elsewhere as referring specifically to the jhana. So it's quite clear that that's what it means here. And slight difference there in just the way in translation again makes such important different impact on the mind, right? So you fulfill the precept, including the sila of the mind. Then you practice the satipatthana anapanasati, devoted to internal serenity of mind. Then you don't neglect the jhanas, which of course are a result precisely of satipatthana anapanasati. then you should be possessed of insight. Next factor here, vipassana samanagato. Sequence again, after jhanas, you have the insight. I don't think that this sequence is absolute. Obviously, you have insight also prior to jhana, because insight and samatha always grow together. You see in the suttas, it's always samatha vipassana, right? You are calm. Because you're calm, you have more vipassana. Because you have more vipassana, you are calm. They're not different things, really. They grow together. But it's at this point that it becomes really powerful after the jhanas. And in fact, I must admit, I like the translation. I think I've said it here before as well. I like the translation of vipassana as clear seeing rather than insight. Because to me, insight is very similar to wisdom, right? To panya. Panya means you have understood something. You have wisdom about something. And having insight, to me, if you have insight into something, it means you understand it. It's very similar to wisdom. But vipassana is actually derived from the word to see. So I think clear seeing there, to me, seems to be very much to the point. You see things in accordance to reality, right? Clearly, accordance to impermanence, suffering, and non-self, and also whatever other clarity you have. As long as the hindrances go down, the vipassana increases. This kind of inverse relationship between the hindrances and the vipassana you have. So you have hindrances less, clear seeing gets higher. And of course, it says here, of course, quite interesting as well, it says possessed of this clear seeing, possessed of vipassana. And this is one of the things, this idea that one does vipassana meditation is not really found so much in the suttas. Vipassana is more like a result of meditation practice in the way it's used in the suttas. The way we use vipassana in the modern day when we talk about vipassana meditation is actually more like satipatthana, really, the way satipatthana is used in the suttas. In the suttas, you don't really find that equation between vipassana and satipatthana in that sense. It's different things. Vipassana is a result of the practice. And it becomes particularly strong at this particular point after you have not neglected the jhanas. And then lastly, the last part of this list and dwell in empty huts is the last one. And you may, I don't know, you may think that is a rather strange thing to have at the end there, to dwell in empty huts. But to understand what that means, you have to understand a little bit about the idiom in those days. And the idiom here, the dwelling in empty huts, is actually just saying anybody who dwells in empty huts is somebody who is very kind of spiritually attained, right? If you are a monk and you want to say that, you know, I'm doing really well, without actually saying it absolutely directly, you say something like, I dwell in empty huts, right? And then people will say, whoa, sadhu, sadhu, that's wonderful. And that's enough in those days for people to kind of get the hint, right? If you want to be a naughty monk, that is, if you want to say something which is inappropriate. And in fact, it is so, the hint, according to the suttas, is so broad that if you say that to a layperson, if you have the intention of actually saying that you have some deep understanding or whatever, and you say, I dwell in empty huts, the hint is considered so broad and so obvious that you actually commit a parajika offense if you do that, according to the Vinaya. It's equivalent to saying, I have attained, you know, a superhuman state, and actually lying about it is equivalent to that. That's how clear that was in those days. So once you understand that, once you understand that this is the idiom of the Pali, then what this actually means, usually, dwell in empty huts, it will often refer to somebody who is an Arya, right? Somebody who has had very profound insight into reality. Could also refer to somebody who is practicing just jhanas, but often it will refer to somebody who actually is an Arya Pugala. So somebody who is at least a stream enterer. So now you can see the sequence there, right? The practice as you go through it. The whole gradual training is there. You start with the sila, you move on to the satipatthana practice, the internal serenity of the mind. You get the jhana states, if you can. You are possessed of insight as part of that process. It happens as part of the process. And then, again, the result of that is that you can dwell in empty huts, that you are an Arya, basically, I take that to mean in this particular context. All of these concepts are fairly flexible. They can mean, you know, they can mean more than one thing. But this is how I like to see the progression. See the progression here. So this is then the path. This is the practice you have to do. So what are the benefits of that practice? And the first one here, very interestingly, is may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, respected and esteemed by them. Now you may perhaps think that it's not a very kind of worthy goal to live the holy life, to become respected by others and to become esteemed by others. And I think, of course, that is a very valid point, a very valid comment. We shouldn't live kind of, you know, the monastic life or any kind of spiritual life just to be respected, right? Just to be looked up to or whatever it is. That's not really the point. But I think there are a couple of things here. The first one is simply that if there is kind of mutual respect in a monastic community or in a lay community, wherever it is, the sense of that we kind of appreciate each other and we respect each other and esteem each other, then of course everything goes much more easily and much more smoothly, right? If the monks don't respect each other in the monastery, it's very hard to, very difficult to have a harmonious life together and actually progress on the path. The first aspect here is simply this idea of living together in harmony, right? If everyone practices in the right way, it's easy for everybody to respect each other because you have a sense we are doing the right thing. Yeah? And the second thing here is simply the fact that although, you know, ideally we don't practice to kind of gain big egos and to be respected by others, of course, if we do get other people's respect, it is a kind of a benefit, right? Everybody wants to be esteemed. Everybody wants to be respected by other people. Everybody wants to have a good name. Everybody wants these things. So it is actually a kind of benefit, after all. And if you look at one of the other suttas here in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Saropama suttas, which are the similes of the heartwood, it actually says there that one of the first benefits that you get from practicing the path is the labha sakara siloka, which is basically gains, honor and fame. This is one of the first benefits. So that is actually considered a benefit, right? If somebody respects you and somebody treats you in a good way, that actually is a benefit. It's of course a low benefit, but nonetheless, it is a type of benefit in this particular practice. That's the other reason why it's there. It's only a problem if you stop with that, right? If you are satisfied with that, you think that's good enough, that's when it really becomes a problem. But the mutual respect, I think, is actually quite important and useful. So that then is the first benefit. And then you should not stop with that wish, but you should move on to the next wish. And the next wish here is, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I be one to obtain robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. Let him fulfill good conduct, be devoted to internal calm of the mind, not neglect jhana, be possessed of clear seeing, and dwell in empty huts. This is the second one, and again you may wonder, why should a monk think, or a nun think, may I be one to obtain robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites? Again, it sounds quite worldly, right? And I think, of course, the point here is not, I think the main point here is about getting enough of these things. In our day and age, it may not be very difficult for most monks and nuns to get what they require of the basic requisites of life. It's quite easy. But the time of the Buddha, it was often probably quite hard. You didn't always have enough food. You didn't always have enough, a nice hut to live in. You didn't have all these kind of things. So if you wanted that, even the bare minimum, you had to make yourself worthy of these things. And the only way to be worthy of these things is to practice in the right way. And we can, I think we all see this in the world. What are the people that is nice to support? Well, the people that are nice to support are somebody who you respect for their spiritual qualities, right? The first one, you expect them to be virtuous and kind. That's the kind of the minimum, right? If you see a monk or nun who's really nasty, it doesn't kind of inspire much confidence. And then, secondly, if they are nice and virtuous, the second thing which you respect, which makes the esteem grow even much higher, is if they are peaceful and calm as well. They have obviously gotten somewhere in the meditation practice, right? And then beyond that, if they, not only are they peaceful and calm and nice and kind, but they also have great wisdom as well. This is the inside part. Then you really respect people. And of course, I think many people would agree, it's very easy to give it to somebody when you respect them for the spiritual qualities. It comes very naturally. So if you want to be worthy of people's offerings, then you practice in this way. And then they tend to come, right? Then things tend to happen by themselves. And you have seen this. One of the kind of thing, one of the wonderful things you see in the West with establishing of the monasteries in the West, initially people were very skeptical. Certainly here in Australia it was the same thing. Although I wasn't here from the beginning, you hear the stories. People are very skeptical. And after a while, when people see that you're practicing the right way, support tends to come, right? And eventually it blossoms and becomes very beautiful and very powerful because of that. So often you just have to be that example. You have to show that you are doing the right thing, and then things tend to happen by themselves. So it's not about, may I obtain huge amounts of massive cooties and large amounts of silk robes and that sort of stuff. I don't think that's the point here. Although you can see why people might want that, I don't think that's what this actually meant in this particular passage. Still, we are on very basic things here, very basic things, but you can see that these are important, because without these basic things, the spiritual life doesn't really work, right? So these are there as foundation stones, mutual respect, enough requisites for the thing to work. So the next one. If a bhikkhu should wish, may the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites are used bring them great fruit and benefit. Let him fulfill good conduct, be devoted to internal calm of the mind, not neglect the jhanas, be possessed of clear seeing, and dwell in empty huts. I don't know about you, but I find this one very, very beautiful. You think about the people who help you out, and then you think, my practice is actually to help these other people who support me. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You are actually there, you think about these people, so it becomes, in a sense, your practice becomes an act of generosity, right? You think, may this help these other people. Not only is it generosity, it's also a sense of metta, a sense of compassion in that. And you can see how your meditation practice, if you think like that, how powerful it must become, right? I'm doing this not just for myself, but because it actually helps all these other beings around me. When I do this, their offerings become more powerful because they're giving to a good person who's practicing the right way. And then you think, yeah, every step you do on the walking path, every time you sit down, you are making this into an offering of other people. Often we think of the act of generosity as being something that lay people's practice. And of course, there is a reason for that, because for monastics, it's not so easy to donate things, or material things in particular. But there are other ways that monastics can, be generous. One, of course, is to give Dhamma teachings. But another one, and a very simple one, is actually this one here. It's very immediate, right? It's very straightforward. There's no ego in it. You're just on your walking path. You give a Dhamma talk, there might be some ego in it, but there's not going to be much ego in this one. You're just on your walking path and offering your practice to the people who are helping you out. What a powerful thing that is. And how it shows you, again, the importance of generosity on the path. If you have a sense of generosity, if you have a sense that you are sharing with others, there's that joy there, the happiness that comes from that. And this is the fuel for the meditation practice, right? So very, very powerful things. And this particular passage is also mirrored in other parts of the suttas. The suttas say quite clearly that if you want to make good karma, if somebody who you give it to, if they have some profound state of meditation, it actually tends to be more good karma than if they don't have that. These things actually are mirror images of each other. That doesn't mean, of course, that even higher is often to give to the Sangha as a whole, but often when we do give to individuals, that is it's actually something that does matter for the karma that is involved, according to the suttas. Okay, so the next one, which is along similar kind of lines. If a bhikkhu should wish, when my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds, may that bring them great fruit and great benefit. Let him fulfill the good conduct, be devoted to calm, internal calm of the mind, not neglect the jhanas, be possessed of clear seeing, and dwell in empty huts. So there you are. This is another way of reflecting, in a sense, generously towards the people around you. In this case, towards your family. If you want to help your family, and this is probably one of the most powerful things you can do, right? You do something, you do the right thing, your family members and relatives, they become proud of you. Not only proud, but they see the spiritual worth of your practice. And then when they die, this is the point here, that when they pass away, they remember you. And just because of that memory, that will help them in the rebirth process. That is really the point here. So, and this also shows you, in a sense, how this idea of transference of merit works in Buddhism, right? We often talk about transferring merit from one person to another one. Now, please keep in mind that the idea, the word transferring of merit, don't actually occur in the suttas in that way. The idea of those particular words, transferring merit, is just a modern way of saying this particular thing, what is going on here. You're not actually taking the merit from one person, handing it over to somebody else. What you're doing is that you're helping somebody else to create merit by doing the right thing. Yeah? So you can see here, this gives you a very clear idea of how this works. What they do after they have died, then they remember you. And because they remember you, that obviously brings them some sense of joy or peace or happiness, right? Because they have joy and peace or happiness when they die, they go to a good destination after death. So this is how it works. And this is exactly the same way with transference of merit. When a family member has died and you go to the temple, you provide some food for the monks, you give a donation. It's the same principle again. The deceased person is somehow aware of what you're doing. That brings them joy, peace, calm, and then they move on to a good destination in the future. So this is what really is the meaning of the transference of merit. And you can see here, this is actually one very good passage which makes it fairly clear what is going on here. It happens after you die. You just have that confidence there. And again, what a wonderful thing that is, isn't it? If you want to support your family members, basically you should practice. You should do what is right. You should do what is good. And that is, in the long run, going to be what is the most beneficial. Powerful. It's very nice because sometimes as a monk, people think, oh, maybe you aren't looking after your parents properly, or maybe you should, you know, do all this other kind of things. But I must admit, I'm very convinced myself that the best thing I can do for my parents, or for my brother, my sister, or anyone else in my family, is precisely what I'm doing now. That this is going to bring them the most benefits in the long run. Yes, there is some short-term pain. That's the way things often are in life. But in the long run, I think it's going to be very beneficial and very powerful. So again, just walking on your walking path, sitting down, think of your parents. This is for you. I'm doing this for you. May you rejoice in what I'm doing. What a beautiful thing that is as well. Okay, so that is about generosity. So you can see the basic factors of the path are in place. You have enough requisites. There's mutual respect. And you're practicing generosity at the same time. You're creating all these beautiful qualities inside of yourself. And then we move on to the next one. So if a bhikkhu should wish, may I become a conqueror of discontent and delight, and may discontent not conquer me. May I abide transcending discontent whenever it arises. Let him fulfill the good conduct, be devoted to internal calm of the mind, not neglect jhana, be possessed of clear seeing, and dwell in empty huts. So here we have this idea of discontent and delight. And the Pali word for discontent is arati, and for delight is rati. So these are the two words here. And it's interesting here how rati is usually a very positive word in Buddhism. You delight in the Dhamma, it's called Dhamma rati. You delight in the jhanas, Dhamma jhana rato. We have a monk who's called jhana rato in the monastery here. So this rati often has a very positive connotation in the suttas. Sometimes it also refers to delighting in worldly things, delighting in power, delighting in possessions or whatever, but very often it's positive. So it's a little bit strange that it actually occurs here. It's possible, but it's a little bit strange. And if it does actually belong here, then it must mean the delight in worldly things. Because according to the suttas, even the arahants delight, even the arahants had rati, the delight in like liberation or these very high things. So even the arahants have delight. So if delight belongs here, it must refer to the worldly kind of delight. But perhaps it doesn't belong, and you will see that in the next phrase just after here, it just has discontent, may discontent not conquer me. It doesn't say anything about delight anymore. And the last one is transcending discontent. And in the Chinese version of this sutta, again, only discontent is mentioned, not delight. So it is possible that the meaning here basically is just discontent, arati, and the delight doesn't actually fit quite well here. So my guess is that that is the case. So if we look at it in that way, then may I conquer discontent, whatever it arises. And of course, in the monastic life, this is very important. It's very easy to look outside, look at the world, and to think how nice it would be to have a nice relationship and a nice house and in a nice place in the forest, so I can do meditation in the forest, right? That's how the mind usually works. I could have it kind of away from everybody else, so I could kind of combine my spiritual life with all these other things. And this is very easy to fall into these things. And this is basically the root of discontent, right? You're not 100% happy with what you have here and now. What you have here and now is not 100% good enough. But if you come to the point, and this is one of the, again, basic things you see on the gradual training for the monastic, the contentment, it comes quite early on the path, is just to be satisfied with the monastic life. This is good enough. In fact, it is very good. It's very freeing. It's very beautiful. And you have to remind yourself of how the obstacles that you often find in lay life compared to the freedom in monastic life. And when you get into that idea, then you get to the point where you find yourself 100% content with the monastic life. This is beautiful. You don't want anything else. And of course, when you find that contentment, it means that desire and aversion, these two things that we try to overcome as the two main hindrances, it starts to subside very drastically. It's not so important anymore. So this contentment, this initial contentment, but being happy by just being a monk, is one of the kind of the root things that makes the whole practice become very easy in one sense, and go quite smoothly after that. It's not just for monastics that you have to have this contentment. This contentment is equally important in lay life. If you think about, I would like to live somewhere else or go somewhere else or do something else or have a different partner or whatever, that stuff is endless, right? Be happy with what you have. This is good enough. I don't need anything more. This is fine. And once you find that contentment with what you have and you're not actually searching too much outside, then it brings down, again, those main defilements a lot, and everything starts to fall into place in your practice as well. You can actually start to become peaceful. This is obviously more important probably in monastic life because it is a bit more restricted than lay life, but either way, I think it is very important. So here you can see you are gradually moving along, right? You're doing the things for the right way with generosity towards other, and here you are starting to abandon the defilements through being content with what you have. Being content with what you have takes a bit of kind of wisdom, right? You have to think about things in the right way. If you don't, not intelligence, intelligence is something completely different. This is about wisdom. When you think about things in the right way, then you become content. You understand that this is what is really truly worthwhile in life, and then things become nice and peaceful. So that is the discontent. So again, if delight here, rati, is also to be included, then that would be the opposite of the discontent. That would be the taking delight in worldly things. That, of course, also gives rise to desire and sometimes irritation and anger and all, etc., etc. So in that sense, it can be included in this particular paragraph. So we're moving here towards more refined states of mind, more and more deeper sense of peace, deeper sense of calm. As we shall see, this is just the development of the path, basically. The next factor here, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I become a conqueror of fear and dread, may fear and dread not conquer me. May I abide transcending fear and dread whenever they arise. Let him fulfill good conduct. Be devoted to internal calm of the mind. Not neglect the jhanas. Be possessed of clear seeing and dwell in empty huts. So here, fear and dread. Why does this come up at this particular point? And the reason is because after this one comes the four jhanas. So fear and dread, usually in the suttas, if you want to have success with the four jhanas, you have to go off somewhere secluded, right? This is the kind of classical thing in the suttas. You go to a secluded place. But secluded places are often also a bit frightening, right? If you are in the forest by yourself, far away, a kilometer from perhaps the nearest person, and you see people only once a day on your arms round, then at night time you hear the kind of the branches, you know, they hear the leaves rustling, you hear some animal walking past, or you hear, you know, the branches breaking or whatever. Sometimes you get startled. Particularly if you have some defilements in the mind, it's very easy to imagine things which aren't there. Sometimes at night I can hear the kangaroo walking past my cootie, and sometimes they sound just like a human being. Sometimes they walk at that, you put the front feet down, then the feet afterwards, you know, step, step, step. Who is this? Step, step, step. And that's what happens, right? This is just the mind playing games with you. And this is what happens simply because of the solitude. And of course, Bodhinyana Monastery is a very, very easy place to live because the Arkut is not far away. It's not very frightening at all. But imagine living completely by yourself in the middle of a jungle somewhere, a kilometer from, or maybe 2 kilometers from the nearest habitation. This is the kind of ideal place for developing jhanas, right? Now, it can be quite frightening here. Even for somebody who is very steady and very sturdy, it can become frightening, at least sometimes, when your mind starts playing with you. And of course, the interesting thing is that if you go to the Baya Bhairava Sutta, and that is exactly the meaning, fear and dread here, are translations of those words, Baya Bhairava, which is in Majjhima Nikaya number 4, that's where the Buddha talks about his own practice. And he talks about his own fear and dread before his awakening. And talking about how he would, precisely these sort of things would happen. He would hear the wind, hear things, and then he would get fear and dread arising. So even the Buddha had that. So it's not some kind of, you don't have to feel kind of bad or feel like you have failed because you have some fear and dread arising. Rather, this is pretty natural. Even the Buddha had that problem when he was practicing by himself. So you have to overcome that. And of course, part of that overcoming, I think, is also the overcoming of the hindrances. When the hindrances subside, fear and dread subside. So these things go together. As long as there is desire there, you know, you fear for your life, you fear for something, then fear and dread will arise. If desires are completely gone, there's really no place for fear and dread to arise anymore. So that is how you can see then how this then moves naturally into the jhanas. It allows you to live in solitude because of no fear and dread, and it also tends to abandon the hindrances by learning how to overcome the fear and dread. So it is at this point that we come to the jhana formula. So just to recapitulate very briefly in what we have done so far, first we have the very basic things. You are dear and agreeable to your companions. There's mutual respect. There's harmony, right? When there's harmony, practice becomes possible. You have the requisites you require. That also makes practice become possible. Then you do those things which are lead to happiness inside. You know, you reflect on the service you're providing to others. You reflect on the generosity. And then you move on to the conquering of discontent and delight. And this is the working with the mind to reduce the defilements. This is roughly equivalent to the right effort, right? To the restraint of the senses. And then the overcoming of fear or dread, which is the abandoning of the hindrances. One way of looking at that, there are other ways, but one way of looking at that is just regarded as the practice, which takes you to deeper and deeper levels of calm, the overcoming of the hindrances that happen, for example, through Anapanasati practice. So again, you can see the gradual training, step by step through the path. And of course, at that point, then comes the jhanas, right? After satipatthana, mindfulness of breathing, then comes the jhanas. And that's where we're at next. So, before I go on to the jhanas, now the last part of the sutta here is just a series of very high states of mind, and I don't intend to spend too much time on that because we have gone through these things before, and although there are many of them are very interesting as such, I think the most practical part we probably have seen so far. And I like to be practical. I like to do things which inspire people, not just theoretically, but actually practically. So I will go through this fairly fast. But if we, maybe, are there any questions on what we have done so far before I move on to the last part here? Is everybody happy with what we have done? Yeah? Claire, yeah? Okay. Everybody good? Yes, Nick.
The part about, you mentioned about how a bhikkhu, a bit about empty hearts. You mentioned something about how it comes into prajikas. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
On the empty hearts?
Yeah, you said about it being a claim. Just to clarify that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, it's just that one of the things I didn't say, which I think is very important, is very often the Buddha was asked by some of his monks, they would ask him, well, I would like to go off into the forest by myself, and I'd like to kind of practice in the forest. And then the Buddha would ask him, well, where is your practice at, basically? What are you doing here? And then they would say something, and the Buddha said, well, you should wait until you have the jhanas before you actually go into the forest and practice by yourself. If you don't, you might go crazy. That's basically what he said. You should have an incredibly solid foundation before you can practice by yourself. So because of that, and because of, I think, also the general culture at the time, it was understood that if you talk about living in empty huts, it is understood that you are some kind of sage, you are an isi, you are some kind of very special person. That was a general understanding in the culture. So if you said to somebody, I live in empty huts, then that would be taken as a claim, right? So because it was so well understood at the time, it would be a parajika offense if you did that, according to the Vinaya. So that is the idea behind the empty hut. Sunyagara, sunya, empty, right? And agara, which is then a dwelling or a house. Yeah. Is that what you're asking? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Okay. So, okay. Let us move on. So now we come to all these other states, certainly very beautiful. And if you wish to ask me as we go along, please do so. I'm very happy to expand on these things. But otherwise, I will go through it fairly quickly, and I won't be commenting very much at this stage. So if a bhikkhu should wish, may I become one who obtains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. Let him fulfill good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. So maybe just very briefly there, to note that the higher mind, this is the adhicitta, this is a standard synonym for the four jhanas, as is also the pleasant abiding here and now. It's only when you come to the jhanas that, you, according to Buddhism, you have a pleasant abiding here and now. It's a very lofty, pleasant abiding, to put it that way. This becomes extremely pleasant at this point. So the practice is still the same. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. Let him fulfill the virtue, etc., and dwell in empty huts. Again, I think it calls for a little bit of comment just because this is one of those standard translations which really give a wrong impression as far as I'm concerned. May I contact with the body those liberations that are immaterial? You can see that is slightly incongruous, right? How can you contact something immaterial with a body? It doesn't really work very well. And this, the reason why it doesn't work is because the with the body here, kayena in the Pali, is basically just the idiom for saying direct contact, immediate. In other words, it's not an inference, it's not something you know is there because you infer it, it's you know it because you have direct personal experience of these things. That is the idea of kayena here, as I understand it. I think the evidence is, for me, very clear in the suttas, and that's why I find with the body is a literal translation, but it's not actually translates the doesn't translate the meaning very well. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of three fetters, become a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition, these are the lower states, but bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment, let him fulfill the good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of three fetters, and with the attenuation of lust, hate, and delusion, become a once-returner, returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. Let him fulfill the good conduct and dwell in empty huts. Returning once to this world. This world means the world of sensual pleasures, not necessarily the human world. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, become due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Let him fulfill the good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I wield the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. May I appear and vanish. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain, as though through space. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. May I walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. With my hand, may I touch and stroke the moon and the sun, so powerful and mighty. May I wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. If you want to do all that sort of stuff, then fulfill the good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sound, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. Let him fulfill the good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. May I understand a mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. May I understand a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. May I understand a mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. May I understand a contracted mind, this means a mind is sloth and torpor, a contracted mind as contracted, and a distracted mind as distracted. Distracted is restlessness, right? May I understand an exalted mind as exalted, and an unexalted mind as unexalted. May I understand a surpassed mind as surpassed, an unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. May I understand a concentrated, or perhaps still, Ajahn Brahm is warning these days against the translation concentration, and says that it's dangerous because it leads to the wrong kind of practice. So still, may I understand a still mind as stilled, and a non-stilled mind as non-stilled. May I understand a liberated mind as liberated, and an unliberated mind as unliberated. To do all that, let him fulfill the good conduct, and etc., and live in empty huts. So of that last sequence there, I think it's probably worth pointing out that many of these qualities, such as liberated and exalted and unsurpassed, much of this actually refers to things like the jhana attainments. An exalted mind is a mind which is broad, right? No barriers, nothing hindering you. And a liberated mind is often a mind liberated from the hindrances, refers to the mind in jhana experience. And actually, it is quite important, because this passage you see here is exactly the same passage you find in Vedananupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. Exactly the same. So what that means, essentially, if you understand that point, is that Vedananupassana, the contemplation of feelings, includes the contemplation of jhana states, right? Often we talk about Satipatthana and Jhana as if they are two completely separate things and they're done in separate realms. But when you look at it, it's actually so intertwined and so closely related to each other. And here, the Vedananupassana, contemplation of feeling, is directly linked up with Jhana experiences. Yes, Huitong. Yeah.
May I just ask, what exactly is surpassed and unsurpassed? You might have sort of briefly touched on that.
The Pali word is anuttara, the anuttara mind, unsurpassed. So what does it refer to again? I think that the problem with these things is that these words, they vary in meaning depending on the context. So you have the anuttara sammasambodhi, which is the unsurpassed full enlightenment, used about the Buddha, right? So it means unsurpassed in that sense. But sometimes it means a slightly lesser unsurpassedness. It might mean something like the fourth jhana or something like that. So it depends on the context. It's not entirely clear what it means to you. I think the commentary, if I remember correctly, but my memory about commentary is really pretty poor, but probably I think it is a fourth jhana that's required, that's meant here. Yeah. Anuttara. Let me have a... Actually, no, I don't think there's any need for that. I think it's going into too much detail. I will leave it at that. Yeah. But the way to find out these things is just to look up in a dictionary. You can actually look at how anuttara is used in the suttas in different places, and you get some feeling for what it actually refers to. Yeah. Okay, next one. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I recollect my manifold past lives, quite literally manifold past abodes, that is one birth, two births, etc., etc., up to eons of birth expansions and contractions. Thus, with the aspects and the particulars, may I recollect my manifold past lives. Let him fulfill the good conduct, etc., and live in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. May I understand how beings pass on according to their actions thus. Let him fulfill the good conduct, etc., and dwell in empty huts. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind, the deliverance by wisdom, that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Let him fulfill the good conduct, be devoted to the internal calm of the mind, not neglect jhana, be possessed of clear seeing, and dwell in empty huts. So that is the culmination. That is the most powerful one. You can expect to become an arahant if you practice in this way. And it's interesting that there are, I think, four versions of this sutta, two in Chinese, two in the Pali, and there's two things, all these factors, these 15 factors or whatever, there's two factors that are in common to all of these suttas, and those two factors in common to all of them are the destruction of the taints, of course, you expect that, arahantship, and the other one is the jhanas. Those are the two factors in common to all of them. That's quite interesting. You see what the real purpose is there of the spiritual life. So, it was with reference to this that it was said, because dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained by the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing danger in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, so everybody happy? Okay. Yeah.
Just one question.
Please.
On an earlier thing, you talked about that they're talking about one's return to this world, and you said it's not necessarily this world.
Yeah.
So you can leave this life not from this world. You leave it from somebody else, some other world. A throwaway line, you said, it's not necessarily this world.
Yeah, what I meant is just that a once returner is somebody who comes back one more time to this world. What does this world mean? That was my point. And the meaning of this world, you might think it means the human world, right? That's what it sounds like. But actually it doesn't seem to mean that. It seems to mean the sensual realm. So even if you get reborn in some quite high heavenly realm, that might be enough. It's not terribly important, but it just means that you, instead of becoming back as a human, you can sort of chill out in a nice heavenly realm instead of having to come back to face all the suffering of human life. That was really the point. Yes.
Returner is always added to Sita heaven, I mean, according to the traditions, and waiting for the time, just for the last time.
What the sutta says, the suttas don't actually say anything about Tusita heaven. All they say is that you come back to this world once more. And this means the sensual karma loka, karma vachara. There's something in the sutta, there's the different types of sotapannas. One is called the ekabiji, the one seeder. And he comes actually back to the human world once, according to the sutta classifications. Yeah. So, yes.
In the human world, because it has equal balance of suffering and happiness, where if a once returner was born into the heaven realms, they would just, as you said, they'd just bliss out, and and that's the end of the might be the end of the training.
Yeah.
Also, too, wasn't that the reason why the Buddha came here? Because of that reason, too?
I think the answer to that, I know that many people say that, you know, that you get reborn in the human realm because the human realm is really good for attaining awakening, etc. That's what kind of often is said, but there is very little evidence for that in the suttas. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it comes from the Tibetan tradition or something like that. Maybe they have some, you know, suttas about these things. But to me, it just, you know, there is very little evidence. And when you read the suttas, it often says that Buddha would teach devas, for example. The devas would become enlightened, right? Or they would become stream enters or whatever. So it seems to be possible in those realms, too, to actually, you know, attain very lofty states of awakening. So it's very hard to know whether the Buddha, you know, what actually happened with the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't say anywhere himself that was one of the reasons why, you know, he was reborn here. Doesn't actually say that. So I think that's a bit speculative. Maybe there's some truth to it. I just don't know. So I think with the once returner, you know, you already know the Dhamma, right? So because you know the Dhamma, you are already kind of fading away. You're kind of moving in the right direction. It's almost like an automatic process now, because you have right view. Right view has been internalized. You know the path automatically. So it's almost like you're fading away. So you can imagine if you get reborn in a blissful realm, you will just hang out there. You will be calm and peaceful, and you will slowly fade away. And then from there, you will be reborn in an even higher realm, right? Say in the Brahmaloka. And then in the Brahmaloka, you just slowly just fade out until you disappear completely. And that will then be the Parinibbana. One of the interesting things, you know, we talk about stream entries. There's a particular kind of stream entry that is mentioned in the suttas called known as the Jhananagami in the commentaries. And that is a stream enter who gets reborn in the jhana world because of mastery of the jhanas. And that stream enter never comes back to any lower world at all, not any sensual world whatsoever. He just stays in the Brahmaloka and then slowly fades out until he attains the Parinibbana. And that is, again, because of the right view, right? The right view means that you tend to just fade out and disappear rather than coming back and doing actions that bring you back again. So I think that is why. For an ordinary person, it's a bit different, but for somebody who's right view, that seems to be how it works. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, so we have one question here from Chris from Australia, okay? To dwell in empty huts, why does the hut need to be empty? Okay. Well, the idea here with empty huts is the main emptiness is emptiness of people, right? That's the main thing. Whether you have a few things in there probably doesn't matter. But the idea is that you have an empty of people is really the meaning here. So you don't socialize. And this is what is one of the crucial aspects for attaining a deep state of samadhi is that you are by yourself. You feel separated from the world, separated from the things around you. That's why it needs to be empty here. Many suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya and all other places as well that say that if you delight in socializing, there is no way that you will be able to attain deep states of calm. you will be blocked from attaining jhanas, for example, if you delight in socializing here. So the idea here is to move away from that delighting in socializing here. It doesn't mean you cannot socialize. It just means you shouldn't delight in it. And one of the ways, one of the best ways of doing that is then to go into seclusion. And then you find out very quickly whether you delight in socializing or not. So that is what it means by empty huts. I hope that makes sense. Anything else before we call it a day? Okay, let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.